Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, the clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She's with us every month, and I'm going to be starting the show by talking a little bit about pet food. Pet food can cause some serious problems with our animals, and Dr. Sandy is with us to talk about that. And, of course, answer your other pet health questions as well as we move along. So, questions about your pet's food, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear those email questions as well. Dr. Sandy, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me here, Larry.
Well, let's talk about salmonella. There's a salmonella outbreak. What's going on?
Yeah, well, this is something that the FDA and the CDC is looking into. I'm going to just back up here a little bit because, you know, a lot of people that have pets, like I have pets that love to chew on everything.
Yeah.
You know, they'll go to the pet store and you'll see lots of different things available, such as pig ears and raw hides and other body parts that have been dried and rolled and compressed and so on. And, you know, when you see them for sale, you think, oh, these have to be safe. They're in the pet store. And it's, you know, and generally they typically are, but there are now, you know, lots of precautions that we always tell people, and now we have something that we've always known that could potentially be a problem, and the FDA is showing us that it is a problem. So, you know, our big risks when pets are chewing on these body part treats, I like to call them, the number one is contamination. And sometimes those contaminations can be from different toxic chemicals that are used in the preparation of the hides and so on that are used to make these things. But probably the big one from the human standpoint is the fact that whatever was in the animal or on the animal could be in these things as well. And salmonella and E. coli are big risks when we have pets that are chewing on these things. And this is what the FDA and CDC has been investigating, is a multi-drug-resistant salmonella outbreak across the country associated with pig ears. And these were pig ears that were sold in bulk in pet stores, in the big bins that you can go in and pick them out yourself.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's something that we really need to be concerned about. Other things that these treats can cause problems with is just generally digestive irritation and diarrhea. They are a source of protein. They have a little bit of fat and fiber in them. And sometimes because dogs like them so much, they try to swallow them in big chunks, and we can have choking and GI obstruction problems. So if you're going to use these are my rules of using rawhide.
Okay.
You know, do not buy the bulk rawhide. Get the stuff that's packaged, made in the United States, usually ensures that they have been processed correctly and may hopefully be free of any of the chemicals and things that could be a potential problem for your pet. Wash your hands after picking them up, whether it's handing them to the dog or even picking them up after the pet has chewed on them. Keep them away from children and anybody that's immunocompromised. And because kids are down on the floor where your pets are chewing on these things, clean up any area that the treat has come in contact with. And so that may be an issue if you've got pets like mine that are on the couch, on the chairs, on the floors. It's like they could be anywhere with these things. Don't let the pet lick you after they've been chewing on these things, because they may have the bacteria in their saliva and can transmit it to you that way. For the pet safety, never leave them alone when they're chewing on these things, because you need to be able to get it away from them if it ever gets to the point where they are trying to swallow it. It's a small enough piece that they can get it down in one swallow where it could cause obstruction. You need to be able to then, that gets to the number, you know, the next number is being able to take it away from dogs. Some dogs become so possessive of these things that they can become aggressive and they don't want anybody to take them away. You need to be able to get these away from your pet. And so if you have a pet that becomes very possessive and your safety is at risk, if you're trying to take them away, don't give them to your pet, because there's always a need to take them away. And if your pet is overweight, really question whether you should be using these things. pig ears have, on average, about 200 calories per pig ear. So if you look at your average, you know, Labrador retriever that is spayed or neutered and hanging around the house, maybe getting a moderate amount of exercise, they need probably about 1,200 calories. So that is a sixth of their calorie needs is just one pig ear per day. And, of course, it's not balanced. So so don't use them if you've got a pet that's obese, that you're really watching their weight, because it's calories that they don't necessarily need that aren't balanced. And lastly, make sure that you're cleaning up those feces, because even though the dog may not get sick from the E. coli and salmonella, some of them do, many of them don't. We can. And so you've got to be a good citizen and be there to pick up all those, that stool. So in a nutshell, should you be using these things? I don't know. I can't use them in my house because my dogs try to swallow them. And we know that some forms of these rawhide, like the compressed rawhide, where they've taken many layers of rawhide and compressed it into artificial bone shapes, can break teeth. They're hard enough that they will fracture teeth. And there, this was quite a while ago, but had a pet sitter that thought they were doing my dogs a favor and gave my dogs, both of them, a compressed rawhide treat. I came home to fractured fourth premolars, which is the biggest chewing tooth in the mouth. And about $2,000 later, I had a dog that was missing both of their chewing teeth. So, it can be a little expensive, too. So you may want to consider that.
So lots of things to consider when it comes to pig ears for you.
You got it. Just because they're available doesn't mean that they're safe or the best thing for your dog.
Well, we'll turn from dogs to cats for just a minute. Andrew in Toma has a question that relates to cat food, I believe. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning. Quick question. Dry food versus wet food. Been getting lots of confusing advice as to which way to go, especially relative to the cat's teeth. Any thoughts, please?
Yes. I'm kind of a middle-of-the-road person. I like to see cats get a combination of both dry and wet. Obviously, the wet food, very easy to digest, lots of water. And so if you have a pet with a water balance problem, such as a pet that's a diabetic or a pet that is has kidney issues or lower urinary tract disease, the wet diets are going to provide them with a higher water source. The dry foods, yes, some of them do provide some dental health care. Many cats will take regular standard dry food and just swallow it whole. And you may not hear them crunching or chewing. I've seen cats, even with no teeth in their mouth, still be able to get dry food down without any trouble. So I have to question whether standard dry food is really helping your cat's teeth or not. But there are different dental diets that are on the market that are either one of two things, either sized appropriately that the cat has to chew it, and is constructed with a certain fiber matrix to encase the tooth, so it kind of squeegees the tooth clean. And that would be a diet like TD that Hills makes, or the Oral Care diet that Science Diet makes. It's an over-the-counter diet. There are some diets, too, that not only have the appropriate shape but also have anti-plaque agents in them, and that ingredient is called hexametaphosphate. And I think the Royal Canin dental diet is the one that has that in it as well. And that helps stop that by that particular chemical in the food, ingredient in the food, binds minerals in the saliva, so it prevents that soft plaque from being able to come mineralized and turn into tartar. So there are dental diets out there that really do a great job of keeping the mouth clean. But, you know, I think just knowing how your cat chews and kind of doing a nice mixture of the two. Because when we have a cat that's only eating dry food and they get to be 15, 16, 17, and we're like, it would be really great if you could feed some wet food, and they've never had it and don't like it, it may be hard to get them to eat it.
Yeah. And there's greenies out there, too.
Greenies are a great option. That is one of the treats that has had the Veterinary Oral Health Council seal of approval, meaning that they've looked at it. They've not done the research, but they've looked at the research provided by the greenies company and said that, yes, this is valid data, and it does help control plaque and tartar on cats' teeth.
So, Andrew, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your own question at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. Going back to the bones for a minute, Rebecca wonders, what about real bones or bones with peanut butter centers? Are they okay?
Any of the real bones, like the beef, the femur bones or anything like that, are so hard that they can break teeth. And so that's the big issue with them. Our dentist likes to say that if you take that particular thing that you're going to put in the dog's mouth and hit yourself in the knee or the shin with it and it hurts, don't put it in your dog's mouth. I don't recommend doing that, walking around the pet store and tapping yourself, but they do break teeth. And we typically get what are called slab fractures of the big chewing teeth. The bone is actually harder than the dog's teeth. And with the force that dogs have with their jaw, that can be a problem. So again, it's one of those consumer beware type things. And obviously bones that splinter easily. I just had someone in the other day with a new puppy and the breeder had said, give your dog chicken wings. That's a great way to, you know, and so not only do we have the salmonella and E. coli problem, but now we've got the issue with the bone splintering and potentially causing GI perforation and injury. So not something I would be recommending.
Another problem related to food before we go back to our phones, grain-free foods. What are the risks associated, if any, with grain-free?
Yeah, and you know, it's not just the grain-free. It's what we call the BEG diets. We talked about this last month, and I wanted to bring up a website that is wonderful with all. It's moderated by cardiologists and veterinary nutritionists, and it's all one word: Taurine DCM. So TaurineDCM.org. It's a great place to go to. That is where the veterinary school is sending people for information regarding diets, the FDA information, all the information from veterinary nutritionists. And so what I was getting at is these BEG diets are boutique, exotic ingredients, and grain-free diets. When we're looking at boutique companies, these are usually the companies that have a recipe. They produce a bag. They send the recipe in the bag off to a manufacturer to make the food for them. It may be a recipe or levels of food and so on and ingredients in the finished product that meets the AFCO standards, but it may never have been fed to a dog. And so when you go into the FDA site, they will be listing the top 10 companies that are responsible for causing this heart disease that we're seeing in dogs called dilated cardiomyopathy. And it's something that is preventable. And so whether it is a manufacturing error by the company that's manufacturing the food that is causing low taurine in the food, whether it has to do with an exotic ingredient that may be put in there, because ingredients, you just can't substitute one protein for another. You've got to know the amino acid makeup. And so some of these exotic ingredient diets, like alligator diets and ostrich diets and bison diets, again, may not be the same as what's in beef and chicken. And so recipes may not be interchangeable. And then we have the whole grain-free thing. To hold the diet together, they have to use some source of ingredient that is going to help hold it together. And so usually there's things like potatoes, legumes, peas. And the legumes and peas have a protein in it, but they're not a complete protein. And so those diets sometimes are low in taurine as well. So it's any of those potential things. And so when it comes down to which diets, kind of which companies meet the criteria, it really comes down to just four major companies that meet the criteria for manufacturing their own food, doing the diet testing, doing extensive peer research evaluation. And those companies would be Nestle Purina, Hill's, Royal Canin, and Eukanuba. And I know people out there are probably gasping and going, oh my goodness, how could you be recommending those when there's all these other diets on the market? But those are the ones that have been around the longest and meet all the criteria that nutritionists and veterinarians who have an interest in nutrition are looking at for the safety of your pet.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, as we take a look at your pet's health. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in as we take a look at your pet's health. Questions for her, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or go ahead and email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we always love to see your pet photos as well. Well, let's take another call. Meg in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Meg. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I'm hoping you can give me some advice at least. We adopted a little 3-year-old cat from the Humane Society. She's a beautiful little girl, but we are having issues with her peeing, and now she's pooped outside of her box. The peeing was when we were gone on vacation. We had someone staying there, and all was going well. They were getting along well. The cat was purring, playing, all of that kind of stuff. But when she started packing up to go, she peed out on the carpet. And we assumed that that was just anxiety kinds of things. Last night, she now pooped out on the carpet. And beyond that, she's been behaving just normally. We have had her checked out with our vet. The vet says she does not have a bladder issue, and she's perfectly fine. Do you have any thoughts on where we should go next?
Yeah, when we have a cat that's toileting outside of the box, both urine and stool, I always, like, besides, thank you for going in to see your veterinarian. Many owners wait months before they go in, and then we're, you know, stuck with sometimes a chronic behavior problem. But the sooner you can get this under control, often the better the prognosis for getting a cat to go back to using their litter box again. So when they're doing both urine and stool out of the box, I really start to think about it's either the box or the location of the box that they don't like. And so I always go back to kind of square one and evaluate the environment that your cat has for a toilet. And I like to imagine that I'm trying to make the cat the golden toilet, something that is the ultimate thing that the cat would like to use. And so we always want to make sure that we have at least 2 litter boxes if you have a single cat in 2 separate locations in your home. And so hopefully that's the case. And they're not near anything like a furnace or a washing machine or anything that could be scary for the cat. And obviously not near where they like to eat, because we want to make sure that we keep both things separate. We also want to make sure that the litter boxes are big enough for your cat. So making sure that it's at least 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to butt. So that may mean that you have to think outside of the box, pardon the pun, but using something other than commercially made litter boxes, like underbed storage containers or the cement mixing trays that you can get at some of the home improvement stores. We also want to make sure that the lid, the box isn't covered. Some cats like covered boxes, but the majority of them would prefer to have an open pan, especially if they're a little nervous about being in a situation where another person or animal may be approaching them. So if there's a cover on it, I'd say get rid of the cover, because that's usually there for us and not for the cat. The other thing that we want to make sure we do is have the stuff in the litter box perfect for the cat. So cleaning it on a daily, if not more than daily basis, where you're scooping, and that's where using that scoopable, soft, sandy litter seems to be the type of litter that's preferred. Now, there are going to be other cats out there that prefer other things, and so we sometimes have to do some experimenting to find out what type of texture the cat likes in the litter box. So I hope that your house guest that was caring for your cat was providing that type of care, scooping the litter box on a daily basis to make sure that everything's kept nice and clean. And also making sure you've got the right level of litter in the litter box. Some cats like it shallow, some like it deeper. And so it may come down to you may need to set up a little smorgasbord of litter boxes to find out what your cat actually likes to use. Right now, with your cat going twice in the same spot on the carpet in the living room, obviously clean it up using a good enzyme cleaner, either like Urine Off that they make for cats. One of my favorites is called AIP, Anti-Icky Poo. You can get it on various like home online shopping places. And then there's other things like Nature's Miracle and things that's readily available through pet stores. But when you're treating the carpet, you've got to make sure that you give enough of that stuff down into the carpet to be able to soak down into the carpet pad and get to the subfloor below, because that's where the odors are going to be hanging out. Put a litter box in your living room. I know that sounds kind of gross, but if that's where your cat likes to go, that's where I would start with adding that second one if you haven't already got to, and then gradually move it to a more suitable spot. And I hope that by, giving your cat this golden toilet, it'll solve this problem. With it just being like two episodes, I hope that, and you've already done the medical end of things, that we've just got to approach it from the behavioral standpoint and get your cat back to having good litter habits.
And good luck, Meg. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take another call. Lynn in La Crosse, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about an elderly cat. It's an outside cat, barn cat. We live out in the country. Active cat, very old. He is losing hair. He doesn't have spots of hair loss, but I think on his pillow that he sleeps on, a lot of hair that he's lost. Is that a diet, nutrition, quality of...
Yeah, it definitely could be any of those things. When pets get older, they tend to have irregular shedding. I have an 18-year-old cat at home, and he will shed to the point where he starts matting because he's not grooming himself well. And so I do see a lot of hair in his cat bed and on blankets and things that he likes to lay on. And so I need to, as an owner, have to hike up my grooming, which sometimes means bringing clippers home and getting him clipped. If you're not seeing any skin changes, any patchy hair loss, it's just increased shedding, obviously looking at the diet, make sure that he is, on a high quality diet, especially if he's older, one that meets his particular health needs. Sometimes cats that have kidney disease or hyperthyroidism can affect their quality of their coat as well. So making sure that he doesn't have any other underlying health problems that need to be addressed. And then if everything's normal, he's not itchy, just help him out and hike up your grooming if he'll let you do that. My favorite tools to use for cats are something called a slicker brush, especially for your regular short-haired cats. They're little tiny metal pins with a bend to them on a flat surface. If you run that through the hair coat, it traps a lot of that undercoat and kind of gives the cat a nice massage at the same time. I also like the one called the Zoom Groom that the Kong Company makes. It not only helps kind of get rid of the hair, but also gives the cat a nice massage, which helps improve circulation and maybe makes them feel a little bit better if they've got some sore muscles and joints.
Oh, nice idea.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate it. Let's go to Pat in Monroe next. Hi, Pat.
Hi there. I have a question about my 17-year-old cat. She has issues eliminating her bowels, and we've had her to the vet. They've done x-rays. There's no obstruction or any medical reason for that. I do give her a cat laxative, and I was wondering, is there any adverse long-term effect for giving her this cat laxative? We started out giving it to her like twice a week and then every other day, and lately I've had to give it to her every day.
And so the laxative you're using is like the petroleum jelly, the malt-flavored stuff?
Correct.
Yeah, and that can interfere with digestion long term. And, this is a common problem in cats as they get older. And it may be, I'm glad that you went to your vet, because there are some things that can affect the cat's water balance, like kidney disease, diabetes, hyperthyroidism, where they are walking that tightrope of being dehydrated and they start pulling fluid from wherever they can, including the fecal material that they're holding in their gut. And then this feces is harder to pass because it's drier. And so making sure that your cat doesn't have any underlying health problems, always a good idea. But for some cats, it just comes down to they just have sluggish GI motility. And when that's the case, anything that we can do to help soften the stool is a great idea. I don't usually recommend the laxatives that are available for cats. They are petroleum jelly based, and it can interfere with digestion. I like using some of the things that are used for people over the counter. My favorite is Miralax, which you can either use Miralax or a generic equivalent of it. It's a tasteless powder that you can mix with canned food. They have to be eating canned food, and that's obviously a great idea because it's going to increase the water content in their food. And so that will help keep their hydration up. But using Miralax, and often we start with about a quarter teaspoon a day to, you know, in kind of increase in until we get the right stool consistency. Very safe. It's not going to interfere with digestion, and it will help keep that stool nice and soft so that your cat won't have the issues of needing to go in for enemas or expensive treatments through your veterinarian.
There you go, Pat. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, a question about your pet's health. Maybe it relates to food. Maybe it doesn't. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. Tony in Spring Green, your turn now. Tony, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for allowing me to ask this question. I'm wondering about your familiarity with this, a problem with these Chinese-made jerky treats. My dog had symptoms of it, and I went on a very interesting site called Poisoned Pet and found everything that I needed, and I know exactly what happened to my dog. And there's an awful lot of data that suggests that these treats should never be eaten by any of our dogs.
Yes, and the FDA was actually looking into it, and they were trying to find what the actual ingredient or toxin that was incorporated into it, but it seemed to be linked to chicken jerky that was imported from China and sold in the United States. And that was really the only link that they could find for causing these issues. And I can't remember what all the issues were, hepatotoxicity and even death in some dogs. My recommendation is use U.S.-made sourced ingredients in food, which means that, you know, knowing where the ingredients come from, and the company should be right up front with that when you're using it, and being careful with, again, when you're using things that are not on the dog's balanced diet, like a treat, that it's coming from a reputable company and source as well. And some dogs just even like my dogs, I can't give them any of those jerky treats because they swallow them whole and choke on them. So, again, it may not be what's in them, but just the shape of them that could potentially be a problem for your pet as well. So I don't think they actually determined what the problem was, but it was out there. There was several years of these products still, even while the investigation was going on, still being available and being sold in grocery stores, big box stores, and so on. So it comes down to consumer beware. Always be on the lookout for any news and updates regarding the foods that you're feeding your pets.
Tony, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Ken in La Crescent, Minnesota, your turn now. Hi, Ken.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, what's on your mind today?
Well, I have a 2-year-old black lab that was bitten just below the first joint in the back of the front leg by a rattlesnake, and we got him to a clinic and got him an anti-venom, and he recovered health-wise pretty well and started using the leg. But after about 3 weeks, I took him down and swam him. And after that third week, he now is a three-legged dog. He won't put that leg down on hard surfaces. He'll do it on a soft surface like grass and that sort of thing. But if he comes to gravel or pavement or anything, you know, he's hopping on three legs. And I've had the leg x-rayed. We've manipulated it in many, many ways. We can't find a spot, any place on that leg that causes him pain. and I'm baffled. I'm at a
yeah. Yeah. Lameness workups, and especially with your dog's history. Wow, we don't see too many rattlesnake bites. I've been working at the vet school now for a long time, since 1987, and I think we've had like two come in the entire time I've been there.
Wow.
So, and it's not something personally I've had any experience with, but I would really worry about, is there some type of necrotic material, especially with your dog swimming afterwards? Was there an open sore? Do we have, you know, some type of other localized infection that, it, you know, you're not feeling or seeing? When we have an issue with not being able to localize where the what the cause of the lameness is, sometimes we have to resort to specialized modalities of imaging, such as getting a CT scan done of your dog's limb in the area, like maybe looking at the joints in particular. And not every vet clinic has CT capabilities. You may have to be looking at going to a place that is like an orthopedic referral to be able to have this looked at. But that would be, if you were to come into me and I couldn't find anything and I radiographed and there was nothing external, nothing on palpation, I'd probably be getting one of my orthopedic friends to have a look, and I'm that's usually their next step, is saying, let's get a CT scan done of the limb so that we can see if we can find any abnormalities.
Oh, there you go, Ken. Thank you for calling. Good luck. Liz in Rhinelander, your turn now. Hi, Liz.
Hey there, long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm calling because I've got a little cat. She's about 10 years old and was just diagnosed with diabetes. I'm going to be starting her up on an insulin treatment here. So I was wondering if you've got any tips and tricks for folks in my situation who will be starting this treatment with their cat. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Well, diabetes is a fairly common problem in cats, and it's linked usually to them being overweight. And so getting your kitty down in weight using, you know, a diet formulated for managing diabetic cats. There are several that are available through some of the therapeutic diet that your vet diet companies that your veterinarian may be able to recommend. But that's always the first thing, is getting your cat on a feeding schedule, appropriate amount of food, and a diabetes-specific diet if possible. You know, most cats are going to be insulin-dependent, at least for the beginning. Some cats do become, you know, where they don't need insulin anymore. It's just like you treat them for a little bit and then they get back to being normal for a while. One of the new things that we are doing for managing and monitoring cats, because we do have to periodically look at blood glucose levels, and the stress of taking blood from a cat in a clinic situation or even at home, which is what in the past most owners have been doing, is we have little home glucose monitors. We teach you how to do either an ear margin prick and get a little tiny bit of blood so that we can be looking at what the cat's glucose is throughout a 24-hour period. We're usually drawing blood sugar every couple of hours. We've now switched over to having many cats using this device that's called the Freestyle Libra. It's a human device that is a little stick-on white plastic device that has a tiny catheter that is inserted into the skin. It goes on very painlessly, unlike us, where we can just put it on our arm and walk around with it. They last for about 2 weeks and continuously monitor your blood sugar. In cats, you have to shave to be able to get the spot free of hair, so it will stick. And we even put a little bit of super glue on it to get it to stick, even a little tissue glue, actually, to stick a little bit better. But they're painless. And all you have to do is you download an app on your phone and you wave it over. In fact, I just got a 3-day glucose reading on a diabetic cat that I'm managing, and we were able to see what his trends were over a 3-day period of time. They're able to tell me when they gave the glucose or insulin, when the cat ate, and I'm able to look at this without even having the cat come in to see me. And so it's non-stressed. It's so easy. And so that would be something I'd be talking to your veterinarian about getting. I think it's really worthwhile, and it's actually cheaper than using the glucose monitors and the little sticks. So look into getting that Freestyle Libra. It has totally changed the way we manage kitty diabetics now.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Going back to the dog that was bitten by a rattlesnake, Dennis wondered if the surface the dog was bitten on may have had something to do with the dog not using its leg.
Yeah, I mean, if it was over a joint and penetrated a joint, we may now have some arthritic change due to all the inflammation and necrosis and things that was occurring in that area. And so sometimes soft tissue damage is not going to show up on X-ray, and that's where getting a CT of the joint may be a little bit more helpful to be able to see what's actually going on.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Let's go to Patricia next in Waukesha. Hi, Patricia.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is a wonderful program, and I am using the Miralax for my 18-year-old cat, and it does work wonders.
Good.
But she has had some lifelong, it almost appears to be an allergy. She has runny eyes occasionally. She has bumps that appear on her neck and her body, and they eventually scab, and they're always itchy. So she is always grooming and never successful. When I take her to the vet, they do blood work, and it appears that her blood work is coming back okay, but they just seem to look at her bumps and say, that's very interesting. But it's really hard for me to figure out what I could do, and I don't want to use prednisone, which is what one veterinarian recommended.
Yeah, and I agree. When we have a cat that is presenting like your cat, we name that typical, like the little bumps that get the little tiny scab on them, miliary dermatitis. And so if you look it up as that, like millet seed, but miliary dermatitis, that is your classic presentation, although cats with allergies can present a whole lot of ways. But that's one of the things that we'll see with cat with allergies. And it's typically found in cats with flea allergy dermatitis. And you don't even have to have a cat that's an outdoor cat to have fleas, because you can bring them in on your clothes. If you're in a communal living arrangement, such as an apartment building where there may be other pets, fleas can be in the hallways and different things, especially if dogs are coming and going. So we always recommend year-round flea control with cats that are presenting with your kitty's type of condition. And there are lots of nice, safe, easy-to-use products like Bravecto happens to be one that's applied topically and it lasts for 3 months. But there are lots of other products out there. You can talk to your veterinarian about what would be appropriate for your cat. But that's always number one is practice flea control. I'd also be looking to make sure that your cat doesn't have some type of secondary bacterial infection, because sometimes these little bumps will get infected and that can add to the itch. And so looking at them by actually doing some cytology, maybe knocking a scab off and taking a glass slide over it and collecting some of the material underneath and look at it under the microscope to see if there is a bacterial infection, sometimes is helpful. Sometimes we just resort to saying, well, let's treat for a bacterial infection, and it may mean giving her an appropriate antibiotic. And there are some injectable ones that work very well for skin that can last for a couple of weeks that make it easy for you as well. And then we get into some of the other oddball allergies, environmental allergies, food allergies. But I would definitely, if your pet is not on flea control, that would be my number one thing, is get your cat, even though they're indoors, on flea control.
There you go, Patricia. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her with us today. And certainly, if you have questions for her, you're welcome to join in. Call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Jim in Oak Creek, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. So I kind of have an interesting situation here. I have a 7-year-old cat that has had issues with her bladder throughout her entire life. Usually her urethra gets inflamed and she has trouble peeing. And we've got it pretty much under control, but the last time it happened was about 2 weeks ago, or 2 months ago, I'm sorry. And ever since then, she refuses to drink water out of anything but the bathtub faucet. And it's gotten so insane to the point where, I mean, she has a filtered fountain. She has also a water dish, but she will not drink out of them. And she will wake me up at all times of the night just so I can go and turn the bathtub on so that she'll drink out of it.
Wow.
Is this like a Pavlovian thing? Some way I can break her of it? Or
yeah, that's really interesting. You know, you're providing her with running water with the fountain, which is something that we always recommend. It just some cats like the running water like your cat does now. I don't know if your cat was uncomfortable and, you know, they often have this superstitious behavior of, you know, I'm hurting, I'm sitting next to this, this is what's making me hurt, or, you know, I'm hurting, I go in the litter box and it hurts even more, so I'm not going to use the litter box anymore. And so is there something like that going on that is triggering it? I am at a loss. You haven't added anything to your cat, like a collar and a tag or something that could be getting caught on the dishes, banging on the container?
No.
Whoa.
No.
Yeah.
She's kind of a special cat. She was actually abandoned. My ex was a veterinary technician, and someone abandoned her at my ex's work, and I kind of ended up with her. And she's a sweetheart, absolute sweetheart, but she's got crossed eyes. She has a dead ear. She was found in the woods when she was younger, and she was pregnant at a very young age, almost too young. So she had a litter of four kittens, I want to say, but it really messed up her bladder and a lot of other things. And so she's been on and off painkillers over the years, and she has eye drops because she also has the watery eyes like a previous caller had mentioned. And I've managed to control pretty much all of it. She's a spoiled little brat, but
I'm wondering.
I just don't understand why she's doing it.
You know, it's a caller earlier was asking about dry food versus wet food, and I'm wondering if you can meet some of her water needs, especially at night, by providing her with a tasty broth of some kind, like taking cat food, canned cat food, and watering it down so that it's like cat food soup, and she gets some water that way. So it's not in a water dish, but more in a food bowl. And yet when she's drinking or eating it and drinking it, she will be getting some of the water, which may help you with not having to get up in the middle of the night because she's not thirsty. I'm at a loss as to what could trigger that. If anybody's listening and has any suggestions, please let
me
know.
A call.
But, I think what a good owner to do that. And, you know, obviously you can't leave the bathtub dripping. If you do, I mean, could you put something under the faucet to collect the water so you can at least use it, like water your plants or whatever else with it? But I have no idea what has triggered this cat's change.
But I like your suggestion about
wet food at night, you know, especially at night, so that, I mean, she's getting a good drink before she, you know, but it's in the form of food.
No. But then Jim probably takes her up and he gives her a little pat while she's getting a drink and she's getting some attention.
Oh, that is it's very possible that this could be, hey, I've been pampered before. I like an audience when I'm drinking. So, you know, maybe that could be it as well. So, you know, I'm wondering if it'd be worthwhile coming up with something like, you know, shutting your bedroom door and making your bedroom, the entrance to your bedroom, if she's coming in and bothering you, aversive, like get one of those. There's one that's called Scat. That's a can of compressed air with a motion sensor that you can put in front of your door. And so when the cat breaks the beam, it sprays air at them. And that may be enough for her to say, oh, don't go wake up dad. Maybe looking at it from that approach. Not a bad idea, Larry. Yeah.
Okay. So a few things to think about there, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, Bev in Rhinelander has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I have a 2-year-old male, a neutered male Springer Spaniel, who is incontinent.
Stool or urine or stool?
Pardon? Urine.
Urine,
yeah.
Okay.
We tried Proen, and then he got some testosterone tablets.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one worked. And I did talked to the vet about surgery, but he said surgery is usually not very successful.
So what diagnostic work has been done? Has he been incontinent since he was a puppy? Okay.
He was fine until he was about a year and a half old, and then all of a sudden he started leaking, and he leaks constantly.
Wow. The reason why I asked is that there are some birth defects that can cause leaking, ectopic ureters, where instead of being the kidneys being plumbed into the bladder, it's elsewhere, and so you've just got urine constantly dripping. It's very uncommon for male dogs to, you know, be incontinent. We do see it more commonly in females, and your vet has probably told you this. I would probably be starting with Proen myself. The dosage is quite variable, and many dogs need to be on it twice a day, if not three times a day. And so that would be something to be looking into. Have you had him on it at an appropriate dose? If you've gone through the gamut of different drugs to try, then it may come down to getting him in to have a urinary specialist have a look at him, where they might be doing some imaging of his bladder. They might scope him to, you know, his bladder. They might do some pressure profiles to see, you know, what's going on. There's a whole host of specialized things that they can do to be able to try to figure out why your dog is leaking like this. That would be, you know, probably my next step. If I've gone through, I'd be doing that with you. I'd be walking, except I just have to walk down the hall and say, hey, I need a referral through internal medicine. But, you know, go back to the drawing board with that Proen and make sure that you did, you know, go up to kind of the maximum dose that you could use to see if that would help your dog. This is a really oddball case. And I rarely ever see incontinent male dogs. And typically, if we do, it's not this bad where they're dripping all the time. It may be when they're relaxed and sleeping at night, a little bit of urine may come out. But to be dripping all this time, I'm really worried that there's something else going on with the bladder and the sphincter that is going to need more than just medical management.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Bev. Appreciate it. And let's see, Norman in Wausau, your turn.
Good morning. We have a two-year-old German Shepherd who's very lively, and the major problem we have is, well, we have two that I'm concerned about. One is, even when she's sleeping, or seems to be sleeping, which is rare, she seems to breathe about 60 breaths a minute, which I know is really fast, and I don't know why. There doesn't seem to be anything. She doesn't seem to have any problem breathing. It's just that she's breathing in and out like if she's in a race all the time.
Yeah. And she has, she's never been diagnosed with heart disease or having any problem that way.
Nope.
Yeah, because normally when we start looking at respiratory rate, I mean, dogs will dream and we will see their heart rate being, you know, up when they're going through REM sleep. But when they're in a deep sleep and they're just resting, their breath rate, I should say, gets over 30, then we start being concerned about things like heart disease. So that's one of our criteria that we use for dogs with underlying heart disease. You said your dog is super active. Although it's really uncommon, we do see AD, like attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity syndrome in dogs. I've had one in my career that I can say was truly one of those dogs. But it, you know, it is a rule out process where you have to rule out all other respiratory and cardiac diseases first and be, you know, doing some in-hospital trials to see how they do on medication to treat this. And we do put them on medications that are similar to what people go on to be able to see if they will respond to it. But it's usually done in a hospital setting. So, boy, I'm really at a loss. And I think that, you know, if you've been to the vet and they can't find anything physically wrong, the heart sounds normal, everything's normal, blood works fine, you know, getting a video of your dog while they're sleeping and looking at this respiratory rate, it might be helpful. So your vet can see, are they, you know, in, having some respiratory distress while they're doing this. But again, you guys are stumping me today. I don't know what else to tell you, but I think that this would be something that would be concerning. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Norman, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Maybe go back for another look on that.
I think so. I think it, you know, or maybe another second opinion.
A second opinion would probably be in order there for sure. Well, we have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with us today. She is a clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And talking with her about your pet's health, you can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We're going to take a look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Dr. Sandy, and she'll take more of your calls and more of your emails. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute right after this look at the news. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We just went through some very, very hot weather. It's kind of nice out today, but tell you what, that can be kind of hard on your pets. And Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. She has some heat-related safety tips to share with you and, of course, take your pet care questions. So there's, I think, one line open at 800-642-1234, and you can always email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, you know, Dr. Sandy, when you put your – I was barefoot in Florida here not too long, and I put my feet down on the sidewalk, and I quickly lifted my feet because it was hot.
Right, and that is a huge problem for our pets because – you know, they don't wear shoes. And even if they have booties on or whatever, it's still, you know, they can burn and irritate their feet. And so I like to use the rule that if you can't put your hand on it and hold it for a few seconds, don't let your dog be walking on it. If it's that hot, keep them indoors or find other areas that you can exercise them in the shade and not on hard surfaces like that. I was swimming at a friend's house who has a built-in pool, and they have this issue because surrounding the pool is all concrete and their dogs like to swim, and they have somebody has to be out there on these really hot days just hosing down the concrete and putting fans on it to be able to keep it cool so the dogs can go out there and swim and get out and be comfortable. So, so it is a big issue. And the other day, I was shopping at my local Aldi store, and I get out of my car, and there's a van parked next to me with the windows cracked just a half inch or so, and a German Shepherd barking like crazy in the van. And I was very worried about the dog because it was quite aggressive in the car and very territorial. But I ended up going into the store and asking them to go over the announcement system that there's a dog in the car and I'm going to be calling the cops to and the lady's like, it's my dog. Don't, you know, and I'm like, well, you better get out there. And I said, I will be glad to babysit your dog while you finish your shopping. And, you know, I think sometimes as just people in this world, we need to be on the lookout for animals that need help like that. And so paying attention, getting help for these animals if necessary. Fortunately, this lady left her cart of groceries and took her dog home. But it was a 90-degree day, and that dog very, very quickly could have got into trouble. if your pet is excessively panting or, you know, excessively panting and they're like a pug or a bulldog, they really have more issues with heat exhaustion. If they've got changes in their breathing sounds where they're really making an effort breathing, the gums are red or the tongue is red, or they're really lethargic and maybe even start to get a little wobbly, obviously get these dogs into shade, get them some water if they'll drink it. Pour cool water over them or get them into a doggy pool if you have one available. If they're not responding within 5 or 10 minutes, that's the time to get them into an emergency clinic right away. These dogs need help, and they can very, very easily overheat. Remember, the only ways dogs expel extra body heat is through panting and sweating through the bottoms of their feet. So if they can't pant effectively or they're standing on hot pavement, you've got a problem. So
there you go. Yeah. Brian, and let's go back to the food for a minute mm-hmm. as well. Brian in Wisconsin Dells emailed to ask if dog food companies who add taurine to their food, does that eliminate or alleviate some of the heart issue problems?
Potentially, but it has to be part of the balanced diet. And remember, anytime the food is manufactured, it can denature these amino acids. And so that has been an issue. In fact, there was one recall, not just for dogs, but for cat food in the recent past, where one of the manufacturers was making it, not doing any diet trials to make sure that it was released and being fed, and they knew it was safe. But the process of processing those cans destroyed enough of the taurine that we then had an outbreak of taurine deficiency in cats that developed the same heart issues that dogs are now seeing. So, adding the extra taurine, sure, if it's still part, they've done feeding trials to make sure that it is meeting the dog's needs.
Let's take another call. Steve in Tripoli, your turn now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We live on a lake just outside Winter, Wisconsin. It's a wide spot in the East Fork of the Chippewa River. We have a 7-year-old Springer Spaniel female. She goes down to the lake and wades. I can't really keep her out of the water. The next day, it's almost a certain bet that she will break out with bullseye-type spots on her belly. And she licks, scratches, and so on. My wife treats it with sulfadine. It helps a little bit, but it drives her crazy. What do you think?
Huh. And they're just like the red blotches. How big are they?
They're anywhere from probably a dime to a quarter size. I call them ringworm because they almost look like a bullseye.
Yeah, ringworm typically isn't round. It's a fungus that affects the skin, and I'd like to think that it was always going to be round, but it rarely ever is, and it doesn't come on that acutely. And it's usually not that itchy. So it can be, but it's usually not that itchy. What I'm wondering is it some type of insect bite for hanging down by the water and having bites occurring. What type of flea and tick control do you use?
We use Frontline and also a Scaliber collar.
Okay. One of the things that you may want to be looking into is using something that helps with biting flies and that type of insect. And that would be something, and obviously you have to be careful if you've got cats at home, but something with permethrin in it. And that would be something, we use something called Vectra 3D, and that would be available from your veterinarian. The other thing would be Advantix would be another product that the Bayer Company makes that also is labeled for getting biting flies and insects. So that would be something to consider. Has your veterinarian looked at these spots to make sure that it's not infectious? Not like a staph infection?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, sometimes if these come up quickly, getting a photo of them and having that sent to your veterinarian so they can at least look at that. But I would be taking her in to have these spots looked at to make sure that we're not, by having her in the water, if she does have a pyoderma or a skin infection, we're not macerating her skin and causing this bacteria to spread and be over her belly even more, or whether it is something like an insect bite. But that would be the way I would – what I'd be doing is getting into your vet and talking about potentially changing to a different flea and tick control that controls biting flies.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it, Steve. Gail in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Gail.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 12-year-old Bichon who has really for quite some years, sometimes when she wakes up for the day, she has sort of a gasping sound and then has a throw-up of yellow bile. And after she's rid of that, she seems quite normal in her behavior and will have appetite for food later on. But I wondered if that is indicative of something that we should have more concern about.
Yeah, I mean, we always get concerned anytime a dog is vomiting, although bilious vomiting syndrome in dogs is fairly common, and it can be caused by a lot of other things. But one of the causes, especially if it's occurring always first thing in the morning before she eats her breakfast, she's getting up from sleeping all night long. We do see dogs that have gone through a prolonged fast, such as eating dinner, you know, at regular supper time, and then not eating throughout the evening and through the night, sometimes getting some bile refluxing up into their stomach and causing that irritation. So they wake up with a gurgly tummy, obviously not happy, sometimes drooling and nauseated. They empty their stomach contents, get that bile out, and then they feel really good, and they're back to being their old self. If it's always occurring in the morning, then one of the things that I do before I jump into a lot of diagnostic work is just making sure the dog has something in their stomach before they go to bed. So feeding them a little bit of food before bed, saving back some of their dinner or treats that they normally would be getting throughout the day, and give that throughout the night or right before you go to bed so that she has something in her stomach. And sometimes that helps a lot of these dogs. But if that isn't helping, then we have to start looking at, is there anything else going on? There's everything from a parasite called Physalopteris stomach worms that can cause this to, underlying liver disease, primary gastric disorders. And so you start down that whole GI extravaganza of a workup to try to figure out what's going on. So do the easy thing first, a little bit of food before bed, and hopefully that'll work for her.
There you go. Thank you so much, Gail, for calling. Let's go to Kathy in Oshkosh next. Hi, Kathy.
Hello there. I have another cat question concerning peeing outside of the box and bladder problems. My cat is 12. He's a male. He's had this since I've had him, which is 3 years. He was returned to the shelter twice before that. He has blood in his urine, and it almost never goes away. He's been on different food. He doesn't produce crystals. He doesn't have a urinary tract infection. I don't know what to do. I've changed vets a couple times. No one can come up with an answer.
I think Larry can kind of commiserate
with
you.
Yes, I can indeed.
So, you've gone through all the things that we would be doing is ruling out, does the cat have a bladder wall tumor? Does the cat, and I mean, they're uncommon in cats. Does the cat have a bladder stone? Does the cat have a urinary tract infection? And so often it means getting urine samples done, urine cultures done, imaging done of the bladder, not only just x-rays, but sometimes an ultrasound because there are some stones that don't show up on x-ray. And, you know, once we get through all of that, then it comes down to, well, your cat has chronic bladder wall inflammation, and we'll sometimes call this disease fluted, feline lower urinary tract disease. There are some diets that are out there that are supposed to help control this. There's one that the Hill's Company makes. It's called CD MultiCare, and that might be something that you would want to look into to see if your cat isn't already on something like that. That has been found to be helpful for some of these cats. Some of these cats need to go on long-term chronic medications. We will sometimes use tricyclic antidepressants. There's one in particular called amitriptyline that we'll have cats on that not only has a direct effect on the bladder but also works on the brain, because we think that there's definitely a brain-bladder connection, that the, you know, when we get stressed, we get gastric ulcers and an upset tummy. cats, it's their bladder that's their issue. And so sometimes by having them on a psychoactive drug like this, not only helps the bladder, but helps relieve some of the underlying stress. And you're thinking, well, what stress is he under? He doesn't have to pay taxes or do anything, hold a job, but he just has to live in a house and be happy. But you'd be surprised, and you know, how cats and lots of little things can trigger this type of thing. So it is something that, you know, we recommend always water, 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 as much water as you can get into him. And this would be where we would have him on a 100% canned food diet if possible. Anything that we can to increase that water output. When we have lots of water going through the bladder, it stretches that bladder wall and releases inflammatory mediators, and they immediately feel good. And some cats have to be on chronic pain medication as well. And so when they, especially if they're having an acute onset of this, we may have to have them on some type of pain management to be able to allow them to be comfortable. So lots of ways that we manage this. And I hope that, you know, your vet has jumped through all those hoops with you, or vets, I should say. But sometimes even going through all of those things, you're still stuck with, you know, just this chronic long-term problem where, you know, we are, you know, looking for anything that we can to help them. But try those things if you haven't already.
And thanks for calling, Kathy. Appreciate it. Well, let's go to Suzanne in Bloomer next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have a kitty that's about 4 years old, and she is pulling out tufts of hair every day. And we did get a dog that, and now he's about 18 months old. And I was just wondering, would it be because of stress, because of the dog?
It could be. And as you've heard, cats express stress in a lot of different ways. From the last caller, whose cat has potentially a stress-induced bladder problem, to what your cat is showing. And it's very possible that it could be a behavioral problem. But we always have to rule out all those things that could cause the cat to itch. When we have a cat that's barbering their hair coat, biting their hair and pulling it out, even if the skin is totally normal, there still could be a parasitic, an infectious, such as ringworm or bacterial skin infection, or an allergic problem. So there's an article I'd like you to go and look up. There's a wonderful website that has all kinds of client education material on it, and it's partnered through something called VIN, the Veterinary Information Network, which is a site that veterinarians only can get into, but it's called Veterinary Partners. And if you go to that, they have a wonderful handout that you can download that's called Fur Mowing, like mowing your grass. And it goes through all of the different rule outs and causes and things that we do diagnostically to be able to get to that point of saying, yep, your cat doesn't have any of these other things, it must be psychological. So, and the cat may not even act stressed around the dog, but that may potentially be what's going on.
And there you go, Suzanne. Thank you so much for calling. Let's take another call. Pete in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Pete.
Hi there. Bear with me for a couple of reasons. I am traveling and using a headset so you can hear me. I have a 16-year-old English setter. He turned 16 in April, and he's been atrophizing for the last couple of years. I haven't hunted him. And I hope I didn't lose you, did I? I am traveling.
No, we're good.
Oh, okay, all right. Okay. He's atrophized so bad. I mean, he used to be chiseled, but his muscle mass is gone. He stands up, he'll fall down. He is diagnosed moderately dysplasia. He's not quite incontinent, but he's relegated to the garage because we're gone quite a bit. And I'm just, is it wrong to have him, to let him go through a natural death?
Mother Nature never made natural death painless or beautiful. It can be a horrible thing to have your pet go through. And I, you know, it's few and far between the cases where I've been able to say, let's manage them until they die on their own. I think there are lots of things that can be done to make your dog more comfortable, you know, padded bedding, pain medication, enjoying whatever foods they want to eat. You know, you want to make the environment as wonderful for your dog as you can at this point. But I can tell you that it's uncommon to be able to have a dog just die naturally, painlessly, and quickly. It's often a mistake. The owner feels. I've had more owners say they regret waiting as long as they have, rather than I did it too soon. You know, really spend some time evaluating your dog's quality of life. And there's a number of things that we look at when we're looking at quality of life. And it's not just whether they're eating or not. We look at mobility. We look at, are they hurting and in pain? Are they hydrated? We have to look at hygiene, whether they're eating or hunger, just general happiness as well. If your dog can't be part of the family and is now out in the garage because of their health issues, is that really a happy place for your dog to be? And then we also look at more good days than bad. And so all of those things are we like to evaluate. And your dog may be eating right up to the end, but if they can't move and they're incontinent and they're in pain, that may be the deciding factor for you. And you have to, as his person, come up with a line in the sand that you know that once he gets to this point, we can't go any further with him. And you know that line can move. No, it's in the sand. So you're going to erase it and redraw it again if you are capable of providing the care that he needs. But it's going to be the toughest decision you've ever made. But I can tell you the relief after it's been made is profound. And I don't wish this on any pet owner. I've been through it multiple times myself, and it never, ever gets easier. You know, they are never with us long enough. 16 years sounds like a long life, but it's never long enough. And you just want all those moments that your dog has to be comfortable and happy, and it sounds like we're getting to that point where you're concerned about that.
Yeah. And it's tough for the veterinarian, too.
Oh, it is. It is one of the hardest things that we have to do because, you know, especially if you've had this dog since it was a puppy and you've been to the same vet, we know these patients and we know your family. And it becomes a very emotional thing for us to be able to go through as well, although it is something that we all very willingly do for our patients because the last thing we want to do is see them be unhappy and uncomfortable. And sometimes it's the owner's comfort as well. If you can't provide the care for the dog, then and it's affecting your quality of life, that is definitely one of those things we have to consider as well.
So tough.
It's tough, you know? And, you know, there's now many people that do home euthanasias. And in a case like this where the dog is not able to move comfortably, that may be a great option if that's something that's available in the caller's community.
Yeah. So, Pete, good luck. And thank
very,
you.
Very sorry.
Yeah, very, very sorry for your situation there. And on that note.
Oh, we always these sad things at the end. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Always seem to happen at the end.
It does.
Oh, thank you, Sandy.
You're welcome.
You are back on August 27th, and so we will do that all over again. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back on August 27th. And that website she mentioned earlier was terrinedcm.org. Tomorrow we'll talk about, we'll be broadcasting live coverage of former special counsel Robert Mueller's testimony. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.